You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, there is a lot in the news. Congress did what it does best these days, set up another crisis for 6 weeks from now. The banksters, one of them was on the BBC yesterday going, hey, we're all praying for a Great Depression. You can make big money during a Great Depression if you're a bankster. Occupations are spreading. Now the occupation of Wall Street is moving to D.C., Chicago, Denver, Detroit, Cleveland, Boston, Philadelphia, Seattle, Kansas City, Phoenix, and other cities, coming to a city near you. And why is the Corrections Corporation of America making so much money in Michigan all of a sudden, even though the crime rate is down? We'll be talking about all those things and more today as we go through our program. First, Peter Ferrara is on the line with us. He is the Director of Entitlement and Budget Policy for the Heartland Institute, a contributor to Forbes, Forbes.com. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Correcting Peter Ferrara's fallacies on jobs and taxes is the title. Oh, I'm sorry. The title is Correcting President Obama's Myriad Tax Fallacies that you wrote. People can read that at where?
Forbes.com.
Okay, at Forbes.com. You start out by waxing warm about the wonders of privatized Social Security in Chile that was put into place in 1981. Do you really want America to imitate a policy that was put into place by a murderous dictator for the benefit of his rich buddies?
Well, you notice how I say there that even though that's been enormous benefit for working people in America, we can't even discuss the issue intelligently, and your question is a good example of that.
Okay, well, let me give you specifics then. Chile, when they privatized their Social Security system, there were substantial expenses associated with that privatization. And they paid for those substantial expenses to fund the privatization, just the transition, by drastically cutting public spending, raising taxes. In fact, they introduced a whole brand new tax, a VAT tax, just to help pay for this transition, reducing benefits, selling off government assets, and issuing billions of dollars in debt. That debt won't be paid off until 2050, by the way. They went from 100% participation to 50% of the working people in that country participating. And because the average management fee on these funds in Chile from 81 to today averages around 20%, some are as low as 14%, some are as high as 30%, the returns that people get on these programs are, you know, pretty poor. I mean, for example, for a new worker enrolling in 1996, the 3.5% gross yield that they got actually amounted to a minus 6.8 return after taking into account management fees. Average rate of return on individual accounts from 82 to 86 was 15.9%, but after you take into account the management fees, the national average was 0.3% for that entire five-year period. Tell me why giving our Social Security funds to private corporations, you know, to Goldman Sachs so that they can skim 20% off the top, and selling off government assets and going into debt like Chile did, is a good idea when we have a system that only costs us 3% and has never missed a payment and is not only not in debt but has $2.5 trillion surplus?
Not one thing you said in that entire monologue is true. The workers had a freedom to choose the new system. Within a few months, 100% chose the new system. They pay half as much into this new system and earn three times the benefits of the old system. Half as much as the old system and earn three times the benefits, because the old system was based on just income redistribution with no savings and investment in that system at all. That's like America's Social Security today. The new system is based on actual savings and investments. So over their lifetime,
Peter, I'm reading
returns.
Your real facts here.
Oh, no, those are all false. And this is all explained in my book, America's Ticking Bankruptcy Bomb. We go into this in detail. It's all footnoted. It's all documented. And everything you said is a ridiculous lie. It's an absurd, foolish lie.
Okay, so you're just going to...
It's just lies, Tom. It's just lies. Like, you stand there all day.
I got it.
To your introduction monologue, it's full of lies. You lie to your audience for 3 hours a day. You should be ashamed of yourself. But the facts are, they pay half the requirements of the old system. They earn three times the benefits because the new system is based on real savings and investment. They accumulate those returns over their entire lives. That's why all the unions in Chile support the new system.
And there are no management
fees.
Even
when they had a socialist government, they did not change the new system.
Then why did they repeal the system in 2008?
Stupid nonsense. sense you support.
Why did Michelle Bachelet, when she became president in 2008,
change it? Why did she not change it?
She actually began the transition back to a government system in 2008.
No, she didn't. You liar.
Read history.
You know, shame on you. Shame on you.
Peter, calling me names is not going to change the reality of the situation. Anybody can look this up on. They can Google this.
Supports it. You Nimrod. God, I get on the show and you just tell lies all the time.
Okay, well let's move to a different topic that you can accuse me of being a liar on. You say take the issue of global warming, and you talk about brave scientists soldiering in pursuit of the objective truth. Over at the Heartland Institute's 860-page Climate Change Reconsidered, you say, but many of our political leaders are engaged in play-acting as if these scientists and their work doesn't exist and there's no scientific dispute over the theory. But the fact of the matter is that the Heartland Institute took over $500,000 from ExxonMobil and from the Koch brothers, that their expert is actually a lawyer by the name of James Taylor, who's based in Florida. I'm getting this from SourceWatch.org, which is pretty impartial. They trash the left as well as the right. And that the Heartland Institute's history before they got into the global warming bandwagon was to deny that cigarette smoking was causing cancer.
That's false. But did James Taylor write Climate Change Reconsidered? Was he an author of Climate Change Reconsidered? Would you have a response to the scientific arguments of Climate Change Reconsidered? Let me give you a revelation. Ad hominem attacks are not logical. So you engage in an
I'm questioning the source.
Do you have a response to the scientific arguments of Climate Change Reconsidered?
What scientific arguments? They're scientific arguments like the scientific arguments that were made that smoking doesn't cause cancer.
They never
or secondhand
that.
Smoking
that's,
doesn't
that's,
cause
that's,
cancer.
That's a lie. It's
well, actually, okay, you're right.
Let me
correct myself. That there is no conclusive evidence that an individual cancer was caused by any particular cigarette or smoking occurrence. That was the position of the people who for several decades.
Why did you change the subject? You started talking about global warming and now you want to talk about
because the same people
cancer.
Who were engaged
cigarette
for
cancer.
Years and years and years, the same people who were telling us smoking doesn't cause cancer are now the people who are telling us that global warming isn't caused by carbon dioxide.
It's an ad hominem attack, you see. Do you have a response to the scientific arguments of the 860 pages of Climate Change Reconsidered or not?
I find no science in it.
If you don't have a response, then we should go on to the next topic.
Let's go on to the next topic,
then.
That's fine. We'll go on to the next topic. Tax policies. You say even before you were elected, Mr. President, under the tax policies adopted by President Reagan, House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and the much-vilified President George Bush, official IRS data for 2007 showed that the top 1% of income earners paid more in federal income taxes than the bottom 95% combined. Okay?
Yes.
Okay, that's what you said. And I'm not going to challenge that. What I'm going to say is that by cutting taxes radically, what Ronald Reagan did, the reason why the 50s and the 60s were and the 70s and even the early 80s were such a prosperous time when we had a strong middle class was because the rich were paying more than 50% in taxes, and so they didn't take their money out. We were incentivizing fairness then. We're incentivizing greed now. What is good about that?
When Reagan came to office, the top 1% paid 17.4% of the income taxes. After Reagan's policies, they paid 40.4% of the income taxes. That's why Jack Kemp always used to say, if you want to soak the rich, cut tax rates. But the lower tax rates, they paid much more in income taxes. They took their money out of
tax shelters.
But if you look
at the top one-tenth
they created 20 million new jobs in the first 7 years of the Reagan boom, which God can only pray that we could ever have that again.
I just don't get – what I don't get, Peter, is why you're shilling for the top 1%. Why do you care? They can speak for themselves. They can hire people to speak for them.
I'm just answering the argument about whether the rich pay their fair share, and this is a thorough – refutation, as are all the other facts.
Well, I think when Warren Buffett's secretary pays higher tax rates than he does, that's not fair.
If that was true, that would not be fair. But the fact is, we cite the data from the Wall Street Journal that people making over $500,000
a
year.
Hang on just a second. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, you got 10 seconds, Peter. Finish your sentence.
Those earning over $500,000 a year, the average federal tax rate, this is all federal tax, is 24%. That's almost three times.
Okay. Thank you, Peter.
Social contract dies in a flurry. They won't tax the rich. They're worried. They're the fringe on top. Don't quote facts, but don't be a smarty. Welcome to the Republican Party with the fringe on top. Our kids aren't learning and the country's broke, but they've got a funny solution. Forget about science and Darwin, too. They won't teach evolution. Hush, you lefty. They don't want to hear it. Anything you say, the righties will smear it. Most of all, they'll just make you fear it as they drone nonstop. The Republican Party with the fringe on the top.
I remember when I was a little kid, my dad singing that furry with... Actually, he had a whole this whole long. This was a song from the. I must have been like the 20s, you know, Surrey with the fringe on top, and he had this whole elaborate joke about this being taken to an alien culture or planet, and there was this guy with a syringe sticking out of the top of his head, and they asked him who he had. Hair all over his body, and they asked him who he was, and he said he was the furry with the syringe on top. And, you know, my dad thought that was hysterical. It was just, you know, kind of generational jokes. Anyway, they definitely have a fringe on top, the Republican candidates. And not just them. I think this issue of why do we want to incentivize greed? I don't know how to say it beyond that. Robert Perry has a piece in Consortium News. The headline is, "By cutting taxes on the rich, we've incentivized greed. How do we return to fairness?" The obvious answer is raise taxes so that greed is no longer incentivized. This is really simple. Right? I mean, Larry Beinhart, wrote at some length about how whenever tax rates were above 50%, we didn't have periods of boom bust in the American economy. We didn't have bubbles. And whenever the top marginal tax rate on the very, very rich was below 50%, we started getting these bubbles because they had all this hot money. And to this day have. And so you get, as a result of that, and particularly as a result of the fact that if you make your living with money instead of by working with wood or working with steel or working with plastic or working with your mind, you know, writing books or creating art or performing in a symphony orchestra or doing street theater or whatever, working as a waiter or a waitress, whatever it may be. If you do any of those things, your top marginal tax rate is 36%. But if you make your living by moving money around, your top marginal tax rate is 15%. And therefore, you end up with investors who don't give a rat's patootie about the future of America or the average person, who behave literally like sociopaths, following the marching orders of the Reagan Revolution. Greed is good. This is investor Alessio Rastani on the BBC day before yesterday, causing the jaw of the interviewer to drop. This is clip one. Here we go.
Traders, it's not about. It's that we don't really care that much how they're going to fix the economy, how they're going to fix the whole situation. Our job is to make money from it. And personally, I've been dreaming of this moment for 3 years. I have a confession, which is, I go to bed every night. I dream of another recession. I dream of another moment like this. Why? Because people don't seem to maybe remember, but the 30s depression, the depression in the 30s, wasn't just about a market crash. There were some people who were prepared to make money from that crash. And I think anybody can do that. It isn't just for some people in the elite. Anybody can actually make money. It's an opportunity.
Yeah, it's, you know, recessions, depressions, they're wonderful things. Here's clip number two on this, where he goes on about this.
What I would say to everybody is get prepared. This is not a time right now to wishful thinking the government is going to sort things out. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Goldman Sachs does not care about this rescue package, neither does the big funds.
And the rescue package he's talking about is the Europeans trying to figure out a way out of the debt crisis that started in Greece because Goldman Sachs helped, as Matt Taibbi documented so brilliantly in Rolling Stone and on this program, Goldman Sachs helped Greece conceal their debt so that they could qualify to join the European Union in the first place. And then sold them a bunch of exploding instruments that blew up in their face and left the country high and dry. And not just Greece. The same thing happened to Spain. The same thing happened to Portugal. The same thing happened to Ireland. Actually, to Italy. Many of the European countries ended up being taken down by the banksters. Here's this investor again on the BBC, Alessio Rastani, talking about what he sees on the horizon in the next 12 months.
The first thing people should do is protect their assets, protect what they have. Because in less than 12 months, my prediction is the savings of millions of people is going to vanish. And this is just the beginning.
And he sees this as a great opportunity. This, you know, he's going to make some serious bucks off this thing. And, you know, he's out there buying things like VXX, which is an exchange-traded fund that lets you bet against the marketplace. Or he's even doing it himself. I mean, VXX is where you're buying a fund where a fund manager does it for you. In fact, I think it's Standard & Poor's sells VXX, as I recall. But the point is that these guys are, they're shorting the world right now. They are hoping for a Great Depression, because they've seen that movie before and they know how to make money on it. Some great fortunes, some of America's greatest fortunes were made in the 1930s. And what fell out was everybody in the middle class became the working poor or the totally impoverished homeless. And the upper middle class of the 1920s became also the working poor. We were left with basically a two-class society. The top 1% and everybody else. And it's really quite incredible when you think about it, how close to that we are again right now. And then you get guys like this running around saying, oh, and it's going to be a wonderful thing. I don't think so. I think a lot of people are going to get really badly hurt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And frankly, I think that there are things that we can do about it. I'll go through some of those when we come back through from the break. 27 minutes past the hour.
If you don't get back with what you're taking for, more you're bound to keep track of what you're taking it for. If you want a little more, you got to get it back.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. I want to go through a list of things that we can actually do. By the way, I tell you, we have the smartest listeners in the world, and in our live chat room, which is, even if you're listening to the program delayed, there are people in the chat room hanging out whenever you're listening to the program. In fact, 24/7, it seems that there's a few people in there hanging out. And they are some of the smartest people on earth. Several people jumped in when I started talking about furry with a syringe on top, or Surrey with a fringe on top, excuse me. My dad's joke. Said it's from Oklahoma in the early 1950s, you know, and so, of course, I don't remember it. I mean, the early 1950s, I was like 2 years old or something. And so thank you for that. And then also there's a question over at Mediaite. They're asking, you know, was this guy, Alessio Rastani, the guy who says he wakes up dreaming of a market crash, was he a yes man? Was he one of the scammers? No, in fact, he was not. Forbes tracked him down. They published today on their website a lengthy interview with him. And he's a day trader. He's not an institutional trader. He doesn't work for Goldman Sachs. He works for himself. But and apparently does quite well for himself. And there's a lot of those guys out there. You know, I mean, the one that's probably the most famous, is kind of the icon of day traders, is this guy who calls himself The Fly and has his own blog. And, you know, an iPhone app, iBank, Coin and stuff. Anyhow, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Torgan in Crofton, Maryland. Hey, Torgan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm a fan of yours, and I love the show. And but I have a problem. I know a lot of Republicans, and some of my family members that I love dearly are Republican, including my father. And I remember reading in one of your books that your dad was a Republican.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of how do we talk to certain people. I have coworkers, you know, that whose spouses are unemployed and have no savings for their kids' college, and they are really, you know, hardcore Republicans. Like extreme.
Right.
And I'm just wondering what to do about this and how to talk. And I refuse to get in big arguments with them. But I haven't figured out how to communicate with them, I guess.
Yeah. I was going to make a comment about Peter, but I don't want to get into ad hominems when he's not here. Typically, what I find is that if you can find, I would ask, you know, why are you voting Republican? And, you know, if usually there's very often you'll find that there's a single issue. You know, they're voting Republican because, for example, they think that the Republicans are the only party that cares about the unborn. You know, it's an abortion issue. And you could point out, well, there's a Democratic group, Democrats for Life. It's a national group. That's, you know, there's diversity in the Democratic Party. Or gun rights. You know, Democrats want to take away my guns. Well, you know, there's actually a lot of gun rights groups that are, you know, within the Democratic Party and a lot of Bernie Sanders has a 100% rating with the NRA, for example. In fact, Vermont has the most liberal gun rule laws in the country. By liberal, I mean, you know, using the Ron Paul kind of definition, libertarian, shall we say. You can literally walk into a store, buy a gun, carry it concealed without a permit, without telling anybody in Vermont. So, I mean, there's a lot of variety. So if it's a single issue, you can usually kind of just blow that issue up. I've never had a Republican say to me, you know, I really want to defend the interests of the really rich people, other than one really rich guy who said that to me once. Actually, he wasn't all that rich. He probably made $250,000 a year and thought he was really rich. You know, he was aspiring to become really, really rich. But does that make sense as a starting point?
Yeah, it makes sense. I just had a tough time the other day with a coworker. I was saying, well, aren't you glad about Social Security? And she said, well, it doesn't have my name on the account. You know, I don't trust it. You know, different.
Well, the easy answer to that is that you actually do have your name on the account. The Social Security Administration keeps track of your investments in Social Security and sends you a report every year in the mail that lists every payment that you've made throughout your whole entire lifetime sort of benefit you can expect from that. So you actually do have a personal account with the Social Security Administration. And not only that, that Social Security money, which is right now $2.5 trillion in surplus, and will fully be able to pay every benefit for at least 25 years with no changes whatsoever, and 80% forever after that, and with the very smallest of change, simply asking Bill Gates to pay the same Social Security rate as you do,
right.
That fund will be solvent forever, for absolutely forever. So, you know, and I've never heard a conservative be able to respond to that.
Right.
So I would just, you know, counter them with the facts would be where I'd go with that.
Right.
Friendly, you know. Hey, maybe you didn't know this, but here's the facts. And then they say, but it's a Ponzi scheme. Well, no, it's not actually. You know, Alfred Ponzi skimmed massive amounts of money, as much as half off the top, and his scheme only lasted less than a year because it was unsustainable. Social Security's been around for 75 years. It's really more like an insurance program. And in fact, every insurance company in the world has actuarials and does rate setting and makes payments using a system that's virtually identical to what Social Security does. So if you're looking for an analogy for Social Security, it would be a pension, you know, provided by an insurance company. And you can buy pensions from insurance companies. The only difference is that the insurance company needs to make a profit on that pension. So instead of the 3% administrative cost that you have with Social Security, you're going to end up with a 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 12% administrative cost on your pension. And so you're not going to get the kind of return that you're going to get from Social Security. And Social Security has that $2.5 trillion right now invested in Treasury bills that are paying, you know, 1, 2, 3%, depending on when they bought them. Some of them are probably fairly old, paying 5, 6, 7%. And so they're actually making money on your money right now. And what's wrong with that? You know, if it was in the stock market, we'd all have been wiped out.
Right. We lost plenty.
Yeah, so that's where I'd go with it, Torgan. Torgan, okay. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Let's see. Damon in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Damon, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Real quick, the movie The Siege with Denzel Washington and Bruce Willis, this movie done in 97, draws it's an example of what we got going today with terrorists and everything. Anyways, yesterday you had Seton Motley on, and he was discussing laying off, you know, all non-essential government employees,
right.
And that would leave us with the military, the FBI, whatever. But isn't that essentially just leaving us with the military-industrial complex? And then
arguably,
I assume that...
Arguably, yeah.
Wouldn't Tea Partiers get upset with that? I mean, if you're just...
Well, maybe not. I mean, you know, Ron Paul's position, or the typical libertarian position, let me put it that way, is that the only function of government is to protect our borders, that is to have an army, and to prevent fraud so that people can engage in transactions in a free marketplace. And so you have laws against fraud, and you have courts and jails to enforce those laws against fraud, and everything is the result of litigation. So if a company sells you a product and you give it to your child, a toy or a food, and it kills your child, your way of responding is to sue them. And that's why Rand Paul said, you know, if somebody's putting benzene in the water, I'd sue them. I'd want them in jail. Ultimately, that would be the result of the lawsuit. Go ahead.
What's their typical response when, like, they're always on about the Constitution? The Constitution discusses, you know, the general welfare of
right.
our country.
Twice.
How do they respond to that? Like, what would the libertarians' response to the general welfare?
What they say is that is not one of the enumerated, that is listed responsibilities of the government. They're in Article 1, Section 8, it talks about that the government... not shall, but may, create a post office and fund it, create roads for the post office. That's the main reason why the government has the right to create roads in their mind, and fund a military. And I think I'd have to go back and dig out the Constitution and read through it, but I think that's pretty much it in terms of the enumerated responsibilities of Congress. And then it says, and do anything else that's necessary to protect or to provide for the general welfare of the people and the common defense. And
so schools and education don't fit.
Well, they're not listed in the Constitution. So, you know, historically what's happened is that Congress and presidents and voters have thought that that's part of general welfare. But the libertarians say, no, it's not written down in the Constitution. Therefore, it shouldn't be a function of government. It should be up to, individuals. They should have their own schools. And if you happen to be born poor in a poor area, tough luck. And if you happen to be born rich, hey, cool.
Well, I learned something. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Okay. Good luck. I mean, you know, talking to your libertarian friends. It really is a pretty remarkable thing. Zachary in Chicago. Hey, Zachary.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a point for people when they debate their Republican friends. First of all, they need to realize this is like a religion, and it's based on their pure belief that when you let go, everything is going to be better.
Yeah.
So the only way you can make them change their mind to expose how cruel the world will be and how people will die from starvation and all people will have no money for heat or food, that this is the only way you can get to them to change their mind that
right. Yeah,
point
out the difference between those governments that govern very little, like Somalia, and those governments that govern very much, like Sweden. Which country would you prefer to live in? And, I think that's pretty straightforward. Very well said. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with my list and your calls after this.
The billionaires own the media and the best-funded think tanks. So while we fight it out, they chuckle all the way to the bank. But how about the journalists who never ask the question when faced with senators and congressmen taking time out from their session to speculate on who to gouge with nary a guilty twitch and never even bring up raising taxes on the rich?
Well, how about them Dodgers and hay, violent crime? And I hear an asteroid could hit us just about any time. Let's talk about that wiener and Ron Blagojevich.
Jim Turk, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, my list really, really quick because I got a whole bunch of you on hold on waiting to get on the program, and we just have a few minutes here at the end of this hour, this our first hour. Bring my job home. Right, and our insane trade policies. Go back to a tariff-based trade system. And I predict next month we will see some action on this in the Senate. Number two, roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Number three, stop them from eating my town. That is, start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. Break up the big companies, including Walmart. Number four, an informed and educated electorate. Free college for everyone. Number five, these are the chapters of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, by the way. Chapter five, Medicare Part E, E for everybody. Chapter six, make members of Congress wear NASCAR patches. Chapter 7, cool our fever, do something about global warming. Chapter 8, change our foreign policy and bring our troops home. Chapter 9, put Lou Dobbs out to pasture. It's kind of self-explanatory, I think. Chapter 10, Walmart is not a person, end corporate personhood. And Chapter 11, In the Shadow of the Dragon, that's about alternatives to capitalism, things like workers' cooperatives. So those are my solutions. Skip in Los Angeles. Hey, Skip, what's up?
Hi, Well, here's so many things I want to talk about.
Oh, please pick one, because we just have 8 minutes. We got 12 callers.
Night, I think it was on Mike Malloy. I heard that the top 1% we're always talking about, since I think it was 1996 was the year cited, has had a 400% increase in their income.
Yeah, the reason, the simple answer to Peter's statistics is that the reason why after Reagan's policies took place, the top 1% paid more into the income tax system is because they massively made more.
You're more or less saying what I wanted to say, which is the other part of what Mike said, which is that their tax rate has gone down by 40%.
Right.
Well, if you multiply
right, but they're
5 times 60%, you get a factor of 3.
Right.
In other words, per capita, they're paying 3 times the income tax now that they were back in 96. So my question is that's pretty reasonable, because the Earth's population has not tripled since then.
Yeah. Just the really simple thing to remember is that as a consequence of Reagan's policies, the very rich make a whole lot more money. I mean, the Forbes 400 has an aggregate worth of over $1 trillion. When it was first started back in the 80s, it was something like $83 billion, the 400.
Well, the question is, in 96, were they paying a fair share of tax? Maybe not, huh?
Yeah, well, in that particular year, I don't know. But good point. Skip, thank you very much. David in New York City. Hey, David.
Hey, report from Occupy Wall Street here. It's becoming less of a hippie movement and more of a progressive movement.
Great.
A lot of celebs are getting on board. Michael Moore was there last night.
Yep.
Susan Sarandon, John Fugelsang today, and I just want to tell people, go on Twitter, Occupy Wall Street. There's ways you can send pizzas by credit card to the people there. There's ways you can support these people. You don't have to be there.
That is great. Thank you.
It's a really way to go.
Thank you. Very well said. And I'm totally behind the Occupy Wall Street. Now it's spreading all across the world. Richard in Long Island, half a minute, Richard. It's all yours.
Tom, I got to correct a fallacy from yesterday.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Oh, and it was just brought up by a previous caller.
Yeah.
He said something about overtime saving money, costing more.
Yeah.
In fact, overtime saves an employer money simply because they control the amount of overtime. It doesn't have to be continuous overtime.
Okay, so I was wrong yesterday.
When you factor in the cost of adding another employee plus benefits, administrative costs,
right,
and all the other associated costs, to have an existing employee work additional hours at only a 50% increase in only their pay, not the benefits or any other associated costs, it's actually a savings for the employer.
Right. Okay, good point. So for the Postal Service, that makes sense. Thank you very much. And I think you make a great one on that. The point that I made was that when the conservatives say, look at this government employee, how much money he's making or she is making, very often it's because that person is also making overtime. But they don't ever fill you in on that. Carrie in Asheville, North Carolina, listening on Maine FM. Hey, Carrie, what's up?
Okay, a week ago, Sunday morning, BBC, they had Mark Bloomfield on, and he calls himself Mr. Capital Gains. And he said Americans believe in American exceptionalism, and they are less concerned with equality. And
that's bizarre.
I wonder what your opinion is on that. Maybe you'll have him as a guest, and you could discuss this, because obviously the guy thinks having money is being exceptional and nothing else is.
Yeah, well, historically what American exceptionalism has meant is that America, it was the first nation in modern history founded on the idea that we're a nation based not in DNA, but in ideals, in principles. that our nation, that what makes an American, is that they believe in a set of principles articulated in the Declaration and the Constitution and carried forward to this day and fine-tuned over all these years to be more and more progressive and inclusive. And whereas, you know, in Sweden, you're a Swede if your descendants were Swedish. In Denmark, you're a Dane if your descendants were Danish. In the United States, it doesn't matter what your DNA is. We were this first. That's the core of American exceptionalism. I'd
add Jonas Salk into that mix for exceptional.
Yeah, we've had some exceptional people, too. I'm with you, Carrie. Thank you very much. Patrick in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Patrick.
Yes, I have an illustration of why the rich pay more in taxes. If there is a flat tax, everybody pays the same, and there are 10 workers or 10 individuals. One earns $100 an hour, nine earn $10 an hour. If you add up the taxes for the nine, that's $9. If you add the tax of the 10th, who makes $100, it's $10. So he pays more, and he's only making 10 times what the other nine are making.
Right.
The reason why the rich pay more money in taxes is because they have all the money.
Yeah, yeah. The top 400 richest individuals in the United States own more wealth than the bottom 150 million of us. And so it should be no surprise that they pay a fair amount of taxes. But the fact of the matter is that they're still paying a lower tax rate. At a quarter of people earning more than $1 million a year, a quarter, 25% of them pay a lower tax rate than people working than the average wage, people making $50,000 a year. Check out our eyewitness account of Occupy Wall Street last night on The Big Picture. It's fascinating.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to The Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the last hour, we had Peter Ferrara on from the Heartland Institute. A spirited debate, shall we say, about the Chilean social security system, taxes, and incentivizing bad policy. I don't know. It was how to correct the problems that America's facing right now. Among those problems, as well as the obvious economic problems 30 years of Reaganomics have brought us, there's this bizarre cultural phenomena going on in the media landscape. And Julian Escobedo Shepherd, a writer and the culture editor over at alternet.org, the website, of course, wrote a brilliant piece about this. Why is TV suddenly overstuffed with buxom bunnies, sexy stewardesses, and Charlie's Angels? Julian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks for writing this piece. First of all, describe this change that we've seen in the media landscape since it tracks back to Mad Men, to the early success of this show that purported to be advertising executives in the year 1960.
Mm-hmm. It definitely tracks back to Mad Men. Part of the new fall lineup includes two shows that are clearly modeled after it, The Playboy Club and Pan Am. And both of them are incredibly regressive gender-wise, but they don't have the insight. I mean, I think with Mad Men, you kind of get a feeling of how miserable the women on the show are and the rare glimpses of people of color. But with Pan Am, especially Pan Am, actually, I had higher hopes for it, but watching it with its jingly soundtrack running through, I felt like it was saying to me, you should be happy. You should be happy to go back and have no options and be a stewardess. You know, it was just, it was bad.
Well, I find it interesting because, you know, I'm old enough to remember that era.
Mm-hmm.
And flight attendants back then, or stewardesses as they were called, there was the beginning of the union movement during that time in the 60s and 70s.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm.
it was actually a good job.
Right.
Now, there were certain criteria. You had to be female. You had to, you know, be kind of hot looking or whatever the definition, you know, all that kind of stuff that we would define as sexist and as regressive. But right now, we've got flight attendants who are making less than people working at Burger King. And
right.
and it's become a brutal job for many people. The same with, by the way, the same is true for, as Michael Moore pointed out, in I think his last movie or the one before that, the pilots on many of these commuter airlines are starting out at like $14,000 a year. And do you really want the pilot of your airplane to be making less than the manager at the Burger King down the street?
No.
And so you know, there's kind of a layer within this, isn't there? And that
right.
is that everybody wants to go back to the good old days. Not everybody, but I mean, there seems to be this movement, particularly in the Republican right, to go back to the
right.
50s and 60s, and yet, and then the 70s. And yet, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you had 90% income tax on the rich. You had actually decent middle-class jobs that you could live on. Being a stewardess was apparently one of them. And, you know, but on the other hand, women were, you know, I remember in the early 70s, I owned a business and having to place ads in the newspaper. You had to call the newspaper and tell them whether you wanted it in the women wanted section or in the men wanted section.
Oh, my gosh.
I remember that, you know, having to say, okay, you know, we had this company in Lansing, an ad agency, and we were looking for a bookkeeper / receptionist. And I called the newspaper, and they said, okay, men wanted or women wanted? And I said, I don't know. I need a bookkeeper receptionist. Well, it sounds like a woman. I said, can I buy one in both? You know, it's like, anyway, back to you.
Yeah.
So, and Louise notes, you know, that there was also a time when women were pushed into being flight attendants instead of going to college.
Right, exactly. And there is a theme in this particular, the pilot for this particular show of a woman who is being forced to get married and then decides that she wants to run away. And her only other option, essentially, is to be a stewardess. And, of course, the show glamorizes the entire flight industry. At that time, obviously, it was very exciting. But, you know, it's sort of hard to watch, particularly, as you said, in this era when things have changed so much, especially for the airlines. You know, women have better opportunities ostensibly, but you know, it's weird to see it glamorized.
Yeah. Why do you think that we are glamorizing this now?
I think generally there's an overall cultural regression. You know, part of specifically for television, there was a study done that this year there are 15% of all writers in Hollywood and movies and television are women, as opposed to 35% years ago. So that in itself is a really telling and sort of jarring drop.
Why would that be? I mean, it seems that women have become a larger part of the workforce in pretty much every area.
It's true. You know, in the study, there was a quote that a woman writer who's been working for a long time, it's not attributed, but she said the situation is getting worse and that in the 90s, networks cared and now they just don't care anymore. And I think, you know, obviously they're probably trying to compete with the internet and, you know, web video people watching television online more, but it seems like their general overall strategy for dealing with this is to make television way more gender aggressive. All the women in the new fall season, there are three separate television shows geared towards really rigid ideas of masculinity. And, you know, in contrast, all of the women are, again, going back to the 60s. Or if they're not going back to the 60s, they're sort of acting like this coquettish idea of a woman in this era that men sort of idealize. There's a term for it, the manic pixie dream girl. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that going on television right now.
It seems that that this kind of macho man and the phrase that you just used to describe the woman, that stereotype has infected the Republican Party. I keep getting these spam emails from right-wingers going, here's our women, here's their women, and our women being the Republicans, and they show all the Fox women, you know, and that kind of thing. Mm. And then our women, they show Bella Abzug and whatnot. And yeah, and it's, you know, or the Democrats, you know. And the subtext of it is, I guess, that Republican women are more attractive. And And I just find it bizarre that somebody would even want to send that email out to 50 friends and say, these are my values.
Right, exactly. And I think even beyond the subtext being that Republican women are more attractive, I think the idea that Republican women are more subservient. I mean, you look at Michelle Bachmann, who's widely seen as a beautiful woman, and she wants to take feminist values back to, you know, the 1800s. So I think there's definitely a cross current running there.
Yeah, yeah. Whether they actually live it or not.
Right.
Because in the 50s, Michelle Bachmann would not be where she is now.
No, of course not. Of course not. But she's very proud about being sort of, you know, the secondary in the home.
Right. Subservient to her husband. Or what was the word? Submissive, I think.
Submissive.
That was the word.
Right.
But she meant it in a biblical sense. I mean, she was basically trying to establish her Christian credentials, I think, there. But it's a very interesting cultural phenomenon, and I think over the next year or so we're going to see a lot more digging into this. And Julian, you've done a marvelous job of beginning the process.
And thank you so much.
Thank you. People can find your article over at alternet.org. It's titled "Why Is TV Suddenly Overstuffed with Buxom Bunnies, Sexy Stewardesses, and Charlie's Angels?" A great question. Thank you, Julian.
Thank you so much, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be back with some thoughts on the economy, on the privatization of Social Security, Peter Ferraro is all about. We got and your calls right after this.
To the east, to the west, to the north and south. To the east, to the west, love people never gonna stop.
Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim, thanks for listening to Green 960. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I was a flight attendant in the early 70s, and I want to tell everybody that I think the resurgence of this sort of 60s, early 70s looking television shows is just fashion. It's just the latest fad in TV. Mm. But I also want to say how limiting it was for a woman. I was actually going into my senior year in college, and my mom and dad, my dad was a well-to-do doctor. They told me I didn't need to finish college, that the best thing I could aspire to being was a flight attendant. And I actually took their word for it and joined the airlines, which now that I'm the age I am now, little bit of a mistake. So also I want to say something as far as the buxom women and how we see women portrayed now. One thing I've got to say about the whole Palin and Hillary thing is my daughter was in her early 20s when that election went on, and my daughter had a choice between two females. One was characterized as an empty airhead, Barbie, and the other was characterized as a manipulating bitch. Those are the choices. Those are the two females my daughter had to look at.
Two awful female stereotypes.
It was incredibly dangerous and hard on the young females in our society, added to all these other things, the housewives of this, the housewives of that. I'll tell you, there's an old saying that goes, the fact that women do not see themselves as discriminated upon, no better proof can be given for the totality of their conditioning.
Yeah.
Women are very much discriminated upon. And I'll tell you, the reason why I had to quit the airlines, I was 5 pounds overweight. So if you're in an emergency situation in an airline, I'm going to tell you right now, the woman you want to go to, the woman you want to deal with, and the woman you want to follow is the old broad, because she's been through so many recurrent trainings. She knows what she's doing.
Right.
It was a very superficial world. It was not a good deal for the women.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, the reason why they said we had to be a certain weight was so we could execute emergency procedures. We had pilots coming in there at 300 pounds, Tom.
Jeez.
It was not fair.
Yeah.
It was wrong, and
yeah.
It was...
Well, we know what it was all about. I mean, you know, to take it back even a generation before that, my mom went to Michigan State University in the 40s and graduated, you know, with honors with a degree in English Lit. The only reason she went to college, though, was because her mother, her father died when she was 13. Her mother told her that she had to go to college to find a man.
A husband.
A qualified, you know, a man who would who had a college education and therefore would would
provide.
And she bought into that, and she actually, I guess, was very close to somebody who got drafted and went off World War II and died. And then after she graduated from college, she got a job working in a store in Grand Rapids and met my dad, who was in college at the time. And they got married, and he ended up having to drop out of college because mom got pregnant with me. But the point is that she then never again had a driver's license the rest of her life. And it wasn't because dad was some male chauvinist pig. It was because she had completely bought into that. That her job was to be in the home and to be there. I mean, she had four boys within 7 years, so she had her hands full. Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, my mom was a big star at Northwestern for her debate skills. My mom was an intelligent woman, and because my dad was interning, took a job in a, she was brilliant. And one thing about my mom, and she unfortunately became a pretty bad alcoholic. She had all this intelligence. She was a great debater. She loved politics. All that went away so that she could be a good doctor's wife.
Right.
She never worked. She was bored. She was unhappy. I watched close up what happened to women of that era who were stifled, my mom was a nice looking woman too. She fulfilled everything she was supposed to do. She had a boy child and a girl child, and she was a very bad drunk.
And it still wasn't enough for her. Kim, thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. It's always nice to hear from you. Dee in Portland. Hey, Dee.
Hi, Tom. I am just so enthralled with the conversation that you have going on. And I wanted to kind of run past some the way I feel about the situation as far as, the Republican, white Republican female being some kind of icon of beauty. You know, if we step back for a minute and look at this situation for the truth, and it's hard to get to the truth because you have to look at yourself. And so what really happened is if you would take it as far back as, say, during the period of slavery, when, let's face it, white men ruled.
Yeah.
And not only did they rule the slaves, Tom, they ruled everything. And even white women were under oppression then.
Yep.
You know, what did they do? Men controlled all the property, all the land, all the wealth. And so they had to act a certain way. That, who knew what it meant to be yourself? You know, if you didn't love a white man and you were a white woman, they killed you, just like they would any black person, any slave. And so white women became trapped into that mentality. And it's just like you're raising a child. Growing up, you rebel against your mother. That's how you reach adulthood. But at some point, you become your mother. You know, so the same thing happened. You know, I heard ladies say, talk about the choices that her daughter had, between, she forgot to mention herself. Mm. You know, how did she forget who she was? It's because it's promoted through the system. And when people thinking about what kind of human engineering, that psychological engineering, it's more than black people that's happened to.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right. Although the overlay of that is white privilege and male privilege, which is kind of a whole other topic, I suppose. But I think the male privilege part in particular is very, very real. Dee, thank you to this point. They're both very real. Thank you, Dee.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour, back with your calls and thoughts after this.
You can act just like a fool. People think you're cool just because you're on TV. I can throw a major fit when my latte hit just happened. They say I've gone insane. I blame it on the fame, the pressure to go.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no, not a chance, no way, don't even consider it. Our crazy alert for the day, caution, exploding toilets. A woman was taken to the hospital Monday with serious but non-life-threatening injuries after a toilet exploded in a federal government building in Washington, D.C., building officials said, according to WUSA-TV. Employees in the GSA regional office were sent a memo warning them not to use the restrooms, WUSA reported, do not flush toilets or use any domestic water. WUSA quoted the memo as saying, due to a mechanical failure, there is high air pressure in the domestic water system that resulted in damage to toilets. The engineering staff is working to correct the issue. There has been damage to flush toilets that has resulted in injuries. We will announce when the issue is resolved. Yeah, I think this is like the ultimate our infrastructure is in trouble issue, right? The toilets aren't safe anymore. It's, you know, the roads, yeah, okay, but it's anyway. Shale in Berkeley, California. Hey, Shale, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I am fine, thank you. I hope the same is true of you.
You know, I'm actually doing well. I'm glad to be on the air and ask you a quick question, okay?
Sure.
You're familiar with the kooky racism situation in UC Berkeley where the kids are having a bake sale today. These Republicans, they're called Berkeley College Republicans, basically having a little bake sale saying that if you're African-American, you pay one price. If you're Caucasian or white, as they like to phrase it, you pay another price. It's sort of a tiered structure. You pay a little bit higher if you're white, a little bit less if you're Latino. And then they have a thing saying, you know, if you're women, you automatically get 25 cents off.
Right. Am I familiar with it, but I did a 7-minute monologue rant about it on television last night, which is up on our website at tomhartman.com. Visit the YouTube of it. It was my daily take last night on our TV show. Yeah.
Awesome. I am so going to look for it. Well, here's my question to you, because, you know, for years I've been looking for a gentleman like yourself who's educated and will come out publicly against what's going on. My question for you is this. My mother's from England. She's born there and raised there. I'm born in the United States. My father is African-American and American Indian. I recently had my genetic testing done for $99, and I found out that I am 60% or 59% European, I am 1% Asian, and 39% African. So being that I claim to be a mixed-race individual, but on my birth certificate, my parents' race is listed, my race is not listed. My question to you is, what should I ask these people? You know, what should I be charged as a mixed-race person since they don't acknowledge mixed-race people? And in this country in general, they don't acknowledge mixed-race people, including our current sitting president. Mm-hmm. How would you, because you're the most intelligent fellow I seem to have found, how would you approach this situation?
Well, what I said last night was that, first of all, if these guys, the point that they were trying to make by charging different prices for their cookies is that they were opposed to affirmative action, you know, and, yes, and preferential admissions policies at the University of California. And you know, how do you make up for 20 generations of one group being the slaves and another group being the slaveholders? How do you make up for the fact that right now average white wealth is $115,000 per family and average African-American wealth is around $5,100 per family? That is how do you make up for the fact that in a study done by MIT just 3 years ago, where they took actual real jobs out of the newspaper or Craigslist or wherever they got them, real jobs, and they had actual people who were identically qualified, or in some cases they created identical resumes and submitted them. Only one person had an African-American sounding name and one person had a very Anglo-Saxon sounding name. And the African-American sounding named person who was identically qualified was 50% less likely to get a call in for an interview. How do you account for the fact that 60 to 90% of real estate shown to whites is not shown to identically economically qualified African-Americans? How do you account for the fact that African-Americans in the United States on average, again, comparing apples to apples, economically identical, pay a half a point to a full point more in interest on their mortgages? How do you account for the fact that African-Americans on average have about 12% of African-Americans get help from their family for their first mortgage on their first home, whereas 48% of whites do? It's called white privilege.
It is, and I agree.
And I've got to tell you, as a white guy, I didn't even understand this myself until I was in my late 20s, early 30s. You know, because when you grow up white in a white culture, in a white community, it's like you don't notice the air that you breathe, right? And it's not until you get out in the world, and particularly that you meet people of color and you work with people of color and you see how the world reacts to them and you hear the stories and you frankly, that's an experience that I'll bet probably somewhere between 70 and 90% of white people have never had.
Correct.
And they just, you say white privilege, and they look at you with a blank look. And so if these guys who were doing this bake sale wanted to actually do it in a way that reflects reality, what they should do is hire people to make the muffins that they were selling. And they should pay the white guys $20 an hour. They should pay the black guys $10 an hour. They should pay the black women $7 an hour. You get what I'm saying?
I mean,
if you want to reflect reality, reflect reality. But, you know, don't do it in this ham-handed, frankly, racist way that they're doing it. I think it's horrible what they're doing.
You're absolutely right. I agree with you. That's why I wanted to call you and say, you know, they don't include mixed-race people. So since I'm 59% African, can I really be called black? Because when I get parking tickets or even a moving violation, the police officer immediately puts B where it says race. But on my birth certificate, it actually doesn't indicate my race. So I'm wondering, who is it who makes the choice, besides the white powers that be, that I, as a mixed race person with European descent, can actually be called black? And that's my real question to you.
Well,
considering suing. I'm so angry about this. I'd like to sue somebody to determine my race because I'm tired of being discriminated against because I'm black. I get treated funny by African Americans because my skin is too light and I don't look black enough. So I cop it from all ends.
Yeah.
Trust me, I do.
That's got to be a tough one. I don't have advice for you. It's your life experience is different than mine, and I'm guessing you're much wiser than I am on those areas. But I can tell you something that might lighten the moment a little. Back Dick Gregory, the comedian, when Louise and I started a community for abused kids up in New Hampshire, we invited him to be on our board of directors. And he said yes, and I got to know him quite well. And in fact, the last time I saw him was just a couple of weeks ago here in D.C. And he and I went to Africa together to highlight a program that we had taken over a famine relief center in Uganda. And he went with me to Uganda and to the German Solomon program, and he'd been up to the New Hampshire program. And one time, and we would just, he just like riffs constantly, you know. and I remember one time he just kind of went off on this thing. He says, "How come you people think that you're the superior race?" And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I mean, I did, you know, obviously, but he says, "I'm the superior race." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "If you have a white woman and a black man or vice versa and they have a baby, what color is that baby? That baby's black." He said, "So it's got to be that the blacks are the superior race. And then if that baby has a baby with a white woman, that baby's going to be black too. We're the superior race. You know, you guys had to go down to 1/8 or 1/16 back during the slavery times." You know, and he just, you know, he's got this whole, and it's actually, he does it very funny, and I'm doing a very lousy job at doing Dick Gregory.
No, you're doing a great job.
But you get the point. I don't know. I think what it does, if anything, is it highlights the stupidity and absurdity. You know, we're all humans here. Race, there is no gene for race. There are actually genes for racial characteristics. There are genes for different kinds of hair, different kinds of noses, different kinds of, you know, whatever, different pigmentation of the skin.
Blood type.
Right.
You see, my father was in medicine, and what really matters to me is people's blood type. We all have blood coursing through our veins. That's what really matters the most. And when I was picked on as a kid and called Oreo by black kids, you know, because my skin was too light or they thought I was white on the inside, really I would look at them and say, "But you straighten and press your hair. You try and make yourself look like a white person, where I'm actually keeping my hair in a natural state."
Yeah.
And to this day, I have dreadlocks. I don't prescribe to any of these, you know, paint my nails, you know, do any things that these other people do, because I think it's actually wrong. It puts a bad image of what really people of color are. And my last comment to you is, I'll make this because I know you will understand. The reason that they're putting all these shows on TV about the 1960s and the most popular movie for 3 or 4 weeks was The Help. Because
right.
They'd rather see people of color, and particularly black women, doing anything but begging on the streets, being homeless, pulling trash out of your recycling, anything to show them, yeah, this is the job that you can have. You can be the help again.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's my opinion on it. But thank you so much for doing the work that you do. I really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
Thank you, Shale. I haven't seen the movie,
You're
so
welcome.
I can't comment on it. But thank you very much for the call. Karen in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a Democrat living in the middle of GOP Arizona,
right.
And I'm finding that with this economic battle that's going on throughout the country, the debates that I've been getting into, you know, with most Republican people, and I've got two 20-year-old boys who have friends who are very GOP, and, you know, government's too big, and,
yeah.
You know, whatnot.
It's very fashionable to be libertarian now if you're young.
Yeah, but the thing is that the thing that I'm finding most frustrating about having discussions with, you know, people of different views of mine is that they just don't understand the basic descriptions of capitalism. They throw out words of socialism and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm no expert on the economy or anything like that, but I do my homework and I, you know, read books. Mm-hmm. The last one being The Shock Doctrine.
Yeah.
By Naomi Klein, which, you know, just, I was appalled.
Karen, we're out of time, but is your point that our educational system is failing our kids?
Well, I think that, and then also, do we need to be better informed?
We definitely do. We definitely do. I'm doing my part, I hope. Thank you, Karen.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm sorry, when that machine starts, I can't stop it. We'll be back with the Talk Radio News Service and more of your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
Don't lift them small minds out there on prime time.
Fair and only slightly unbalanced, Tom Hartman here with you, and Theodore in Stevenson, Washington. Hey, Theodore, welcome back.
Tom, I'm a big fan. I listen a lot, even though, you know, we go around and round. But, Tom, I wanted to take exception to your position on this strike yesterday. And
the nurses' strike.
Yeah, and the nurses that called in, you know, they said that there was going to be less patient safety. And I am a nurse. I'm California licensed. I've practiced from Orange County to in California to Clark County in Washington. And the thing is, Tom, in California, they have very dangerous hospitals, and one of the reasons, and this is why patient safety probably improved, is that they love to use foreign nurses from unaccredited schools that can barely speak English. And then they replace them with likely American nurses that, if you look statistically, and I can give you the study that would support this, you will look statistically and you will find that the better educated nurses who are from accredited schools have a better safety record.
That makes perfect sense, Theodore. When did California start allowing foreign, less educated nurses to come into their hospitals?
They've been doing it since the late 60s.
Yeah.
They primarily come from a certain Pacific nation.
From the Philippines.
And I think they have one accredited school in the Philippines, and these people basically would be barred from many states in the Northwest from practicing, but they can try to pass that test between 6 and 12 times down in California, and if they pass it after the 12th time and it's just a kind of a random pass, mm-hmm. they get a nursing license, and
yeah.
they act in unison to cover each other's behinds, and it's a murderous situation, and it's
yeah.
one of the reasons that places like in L.A., where I've done a lot of practice, that you will see that it's a lot more money, and there's a lot more ICU stays for the same kind of illnesses as, say, in the upper Midwest,
right.
et cetera, et cetera.
And you think this is because of the difference in the quality of nursing? Theodore, you know, along with engineers who call into this program to talk about how engineers are coming from India and taking their jobs at half the wage, I think that, you know, you're making a compelling case for us to have a better educational infrastructure in the United States, that anybody who wants to become a nurse should be able to. Anybody who wants to go through, because it's a rigorous educational. One of my kids just graduated nursing college, and it's no
That's
small
my,
thing. It was damn
it's
tough.
Tough situation. And talking about the engineering, Boeing took 3 extra years to get that 787 out, Tom, and it cost their shareholders a lot of money
mm-hmm.
because they tried to offshore the engineering, and it was all screwed up.
Yeah, okay. Excellent point. Theodore, you know, usually we're fighting with each other. I agree with you. And this goes back to insane trade policies that, you know, call me a nativist if you want. I wouldn't call myself that, but I know that that's the fashionable thing to say when somebody says that they're in favor of protectionism. But I think that America should be looking out for Americans and should be encouraging Mexico to look out for Mexicans and China to look out for Chinese and, you know, fill in the blank. I think that there's a reason why we have countries. There's a reason why we have states. There's a reason why we have towns. There's a reason why we have communities and families. It all has to do with a whole long anthropological thing. But I think it's ultimately a good reason, and we should be acknowledging that. Anyhow, Cornell Terry in Monterey Bay.
Yes, indeed, Tom. I want to compliment you so very, very highly. Okay, you add insight, intelligence, and you're doing such a job. In fact, you've improved my capacity over the years to know about reality. And the reality I want to address is we are failing to see real solutions provided to us by either party, sir.
Yes.
And Obama tragically failed to implement so many solutions, starting with campaign finance reform, enforcement of our anti-monopoly laws against big oil, big banks, big insurance companies, and so forth, and the big media.
If I may, just very quickly, and then you can continue.
Sure.
In his defense, and that's certainly not my job here, but it needs to be said that. His inability to do, we're talking about laws that need to be passed, and the Supreme Court has made things so difficult for any president since basically the mid 70s, with the Buckley decision, the emergence of corporate personhood, the emergence of laws that, mm-hmm. that basically weight the scales, put a thumb on the scales for rich people, the scales of justice and the scales of lawmaking. You know, when Ronald Reagan came into office, there were fewer than 300 lobbyists in this town. There's 37,000 of them now. This is the result of Supreme Court decisions. And so you can't blame it all on one guy who's been in the White House for 3 years.
No, but, you know, the guy's got a – he was editor of the Harvard Law Review, so he understands our economic and legal history through the Supreme Court decisions for sure.
Yeah.
And he knows that we need a restoration of, if you will, Teddy Roosevelt's antitrust approaches across the spectrum from monopolies in all those industries, including the insane way, to use your word, that we finance campaigns.
Yeah.
And for his failure to say, do we want a government that is for all of us or a government that reflects a fascist – corporatist-owned style of either Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. Do we? These are the trends we're going to.
Or something in between.
I really fault him for not adopting and implementing much of your observations, frankly, which are accurate and true and respect wisdom. I also want to add that Buddy Romer, I think, has a solution. And here's a guy smart enough to have an MBA from Harvard and run a bank well.
Buddy Romer is a crackpot.
I think that Romer deserves the support of all of us.
I'm sorry.
Republican nomination.
I'm sorry, Cornell. Buddy Romer is a crackpot. He's a Republican crackpot, but he's a crackpot. And particularly his tax ideas are crackpot tax ideas. He's been on this program. We've had that conversation. And if you want to pick on Obama, your words will have more credibility if you first called and said, you know, I have shown up at the Democratic Party meetings.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the movement. Remember the old, what if they gave a revolution, or what if they gave a war and no one came? What if they gave a revolution and no one came? Well, people are coming. And they're coming in New York right now, Occupy Wall Street. There's an Occupy Now movement that's spreading across the country. And next week, there's going to be a whole lot of people occupying a building, a Hilton Hotel here in Washington, D.C. Can a movement save the American dream? I mean, this is actually a fundamental question. We tend to think of politicians and parties as the things that save the American dream. I would suggest to you that they never have saved the American dream or created the American dream. It has always been movements. And one of the guys who has been right out of the front of this for years and years and really understands this well, Robert Borisaj, is with us. He's the founder and president of the Institute for America's Future, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, the website ourfuture.org. Robert Borisaj, welcome back to the program, Robert.
My pleasure. How are you?
Very good, very good. And thank you for joining us. Tell us, first of all, You wrote a great piece with Katrina VandenHeuvel in the American in the Nation. Can a movement save the American dream? Can a movement save the American dream?
Well, I think what we say is that we think only a movement can save the American dream. You know, historically, when America reached these levels of extreme inequality that we have now, where 1% of the top 1% of Americans make as much money as the bottom 60% and have as much wealth as the bottom 90%, we've reached these extremes previously, and it's always been very populist citizen movements that have organized, demonstrated, created ideas, run politicians, created political parties. You know, the populists in the late turn of the 1900s, the 1800s, that challenged the robber barons and began the process of putting rules around capitalism. Then the socialists and the communists and the labor movement and Huey Long and the Townsend movement in the 30s that drove Roosevelt to do the New Deal that we remember, that had Social Security and the Wagner Act and the right to organize in it. All of those things were driven not by politicians, but by citizen movements operating and challenging the limits of a debate that was being dominated by big money.
Yeah, very, very well said. I'm curious if you're familiar and if you have a level of familiarity with the late 19th century. I don't. To know why Grover Cleveland was the only Democrat who served during that time. He had two terms that were not contiguous. And if there was a revolutionary moment, I mean, clearly the Civil War was a revolutionary moment. Reconstruction was a revolutionary moment. But then what happened between the 1870s and 1905 and Teddy Roosevelt and whatnot?
Well, you had a very long economic depression, really. As industrialization proceeded and the horrors that were factories at that time, where the right to organize was literally considered against the Constitution, and workers were, in hell hose working 7 days a week, no limits on hours, no overtime, et cetera. Cleveland was really the new Democrat of his time. He was not much of a reformer. He embraced the big money politics, and it was one of the reasons why a populist movement, the People's Party, kind of arose out of the Midwest and began to unite labor with small farmers who were just getting screwed by the railroads.
Right, the Grange movement,
and began to demand looser money, silver, not just gold standard, that would make it easier to borrow money and easier for farmers to be able to borrow while they had to plant seeds and wait for crops to grow. And then antitrust legislation that would take on the railroad monopoly and the steel monopoly and the other monopolies that were really wrenching people with prices. And then massive and vicious organizing drives around an attempt to give workers some rights at the workplace.
Yeah. The thing that I always found fascinating was in his 1887, annual State of the Nation speech, he talked about how the rise of corporate interests has led to the average, to great wealth at the top, and the average man lays with the iron heel of corporations on his neck. And I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close. And I thought that's a hell of a thing for a president to say in the late 19th century, you know. But in any case, here we are. The economy works fabulously well for a few, you write. The richest 1% capture nearly a quarter of the nation's income and control 40% of its wealth. They've pocketed almost all of the rewards of the past decade's economic growth. I would say the past three decades even. Tahrir Square erupted in revolution in January. Is America on the edge of a revolution, not a shooting kind of revolution, but a political revolution like the New Deal was? Like, frankly, I think the Reagan revolution was a revolution.
Yeah, I think we're at the point where the entrenched politics and interests of the last 30 years, the conservative ideas, the corporate interests, have now led the economy off the cliff and have created an economy that doesn't work for most Americans. And it's at that point where you get these eruptions. The Tea Party is a form of that eruption, distorted, I think, by the money that backs it and kind of cynical politics underneath it. But it expresses this sense that Washington's working for a very few wired interests, and it's not working for everyday Americans. And I think you see that in the Occupy Wall Street movement, which, you know, starts out with a group that no one knows before, right? And yet captures the spirit of the time, the sense that these big banks have been bailed out at the cost of trillions of dollars. And are back to making 30% of all corporate profits, and meanwhile they're the ones who caused the mess and the crisis,
right.
And we're the ones asked to pay for it.
You know,
I think you're going to get real upheaval and a real change in our politics.
Yeah, this young man in Tunisia, the college-educated young man who couldn't get a job, he was selling fruit on the street, and he got ripped off, and he flipped out. He poured gasoline on himself and caught himself on fire, self-immolated, and that moment started the Arab Spring. And
a literal spark.
Yeah. And it seems to me that when we look back a year or two from now, we're going to see the moment when this police officer put pepper spray in the eyes of these young women in New York City last week who were trying to occupy Wall Street, who were doing nothing other than just standing there. That may well be the spark, because now we have 10 or 12 cities where there are Occupy Detroit, Occupy Seattle, Occupy Chicago, movements that are erupting right now out of this. Do you think it's possible?
I think it's possible. And remember, it's preceded even this. So we had the assault in Wisconsin on worker rights and an extraordinary outpouring, you know, tens of thousands of people occupying the Capitol, students and non-union workers and middle-class people coming to the defense of workers, and a sense in Wisconsin that, wait a minute, this thing is way too extreme, and now they're really crushing the American dream.
But I think this is even broader. Robert, we just have a little bit of time. I want to mention that next week you're running a conference, the Take Back the or what tell us
Take
about the
Back
conference.
The American Dream next week, Monday through Wednesday in Washington at the Hilton. You can get information about the agenda and register at ourfuture.org. This is a really important gathering.
Right.
This is activists from around the country coming together to try to plan out the next 18 months and how we build a popular movement that is militant, that is intent not just on demonstrating but on taking power, on running candidates, on challenging Democrats that have gone to the other side, on taking on the right wing that seems intent on destroying the economy. And building a movement that can make America work for working people again.
And we will be doing this show live from the Free Speech TV E studio in the Hilton at the Take Back the American Dream conference that you can read about at ourfuture.org. We'll be there all next week. Thank you, Robert.
My pleasure.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So if you happen to be in or around D.C. next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, drop by and say hi. We'll be giving out Tom Hartman University bumper stickers. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you over at Tumblr.com. AnonCentral.tumblr.com, the anonymous central spot for posting things. The headline, attention, hashtag Occupy Wall Street, bad cop docs, target, and then they name the officer and New York Police Department, hashtag NYPD. And what I find fascinating about this is there's a photo of the police officer who is... the photo doesn't actually show him macing these women in the face. There is a fair amount of video of it, but in that, I've kind of slow-mo'd it, and I just see the hand coming in, but apparently I haven't seen all the pictures. They believe this to be a clear identification of this particular police officer, and so they show a photo of him and a photo of his badge, and his name is on there, and that should be public. I mean, we want our police officers to be accountable because this country has a long history. In fact, I would argue that a substantial part of the history that we have of police violence or the violence committed against the people by authorities in power was pre-revolutionary and led in part to the Revolutionary War. And so we want our police officers to identify themselves. I remember when I was in Minneapolis for the Republican National Convention in 2008, we were doing our show from there and from our affiliate there, AM 950, and which is just a great radio station. And there were these police officers that were coming in, and they were wearing outfits where you couldn't identify them. You know, their names were not visible. Their badges were not visible. There was no way to know who they were. And I think that kind of anonymity is, frankly, dangerous for authority figures and people who are armed in the United States. And, frankly, I believe it should be against the law. But here's the question, and there's a spirited discussion about this. They name this police officer, and they name 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 members of his family. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I don't know, 15 or so of his previous addresses. And then they point out that he's also been charged with violating the civil rights of another number of other individuals back in 2007, which, you know, I don't know what that means. Typically, a civil rights violation is a euphemism for police brutality or police overstepping their bounds. And they have the case number and all this kind of stuff posted there. And in my mind, identifying him is a good and proper thing. Identifying the fact that he has a history, if this really is the guy, of at least being charged with breaking the law. This doesn't say clearly whether there was a conviction or not, or whether the case is still open or what. Or I don't, either that or I don't know how to read these. I think that that's a good and appropriate thing. That's transparency in government. This is an official of our government. And this is where I think liberals, conservatives, and libertarians should all agree that authority figures that we the people have given authority to, authority figures who we the people have paid, authority figures that we the people have armed to defend us, when they assault us, should be identified and should be held accountable. But Anonymous went a step beyond that. They gave his family members' names and his address, his home address. And, you know, there's a fascinating thread over at democraticunderground.com right now titled Anonymous Outs Mace Cop, I Stand With Anonymous is the title of the thread. And when you link over to the story on Tumblr, where Anonymous actually outed the cop, some of the responses are, for example, you know, somebody says name and family, you know, here's one. This is Septima says his family does not need to be involved. That's a step too far. Casualties are one thing, but intentional casualties are another. Do not become the monster so early in the game. And then on the other hand, you have people saying, well, the police and corporate state know no boundaries, so they set the precedent here. I get calls from my friend's bank at 8 in the morning because she's late on her mortgage. The fact that Anonymous can erase that thin blue line signifies a fine day. And then here's another one that says, name and shame his family, too. Hell yeah, these got, you know, and they go on with a rant about it. My take on this is that identifying him is fine. Identifying his past is fine. Putting up the telephone number of the precinct that he works out of is fine. Naming his wife or his kids or his nieces and nephews or brothers or sisters or whatever is not necessary. That it actually diminishes, and giving out his home address, that it actually diminishes the moral authority associated with outing him. You know, I understand the arguments. And, you know, you have a lawbreaker, and in fact, I can argue the other side. if those women that he maced in the face, assuming that this is the guy who did that, if the women that he had maced were arrested, their home addresses, as a consequence of their arrest, would become matters of public record. So why shouldn't his home address? That's the argument on the other side. And I understand that, and I have some ambivalence about that. I'm curious your thoughts on that. How far should we go? Or how far should Anonymous have gone in this outing? 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls and the good, the bad, and the seriously ugly. The good, the bad, and the very, very luxotically ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, McKinney, the North Carolina-based advertising company, created a new online video game to raise awareness about poverty in America. In the game, called Spent, players lose their jobs and are forced to make ends meet, pay for food, rent, and bills on just $8 an hour on an $8 an hour job. The game's developers hope it will raise people's consciousness about homelessness in America and how easily it can happen to anybody. As one great game creator said, it's a way for people out there sitting at their high-speed connections with a nice job, probably a little money in the bank, to feel what it's like to jump from where they are to where someone who ends up in a shelter is at. Let's see if we can get Republicans like Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor to play it. Maybe then they'll have a little compassion for desperate Americans. The bad. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the guy who is notorious for his inhumane outdoor prisons, maniacal obsession with illegal immigrants, and crusades to find out if President Obama's birth certificate is real, recently went on a local news program in Arizona to take some questions from viewers. When asked a pointed question of why he was racist against Latinos, Sheriff Joe gave a pretty odd answer, saying, "I'm not going to get into my personal life." As in, he doesn't want to talk about his personal racist attitudes towards Latinos? Maybe that's why Sheriff Joe is called America's Sheriff by conservatives. I think he needs some media training. When you're asked if you're a racist, always answer no. And the very, very ugly Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president of the National Rifle Association, channeled his inner paranoia to spew a conspiracy theory about President Obama's intention to take away everyone's guns. At last week's CPAC conference, LaPierre told the audience, "In public, the president will remind us that he's put off calls from his party to renew the old Clinton ban, that he hasn't pushed for new gun control laws, that it's a big, fat stinking lie. It's all part of a massive Obama conspiracy to deceive voters and hide his true intentions to destroy the Second Amendment in our country." End of quote. Right, because that's what we all need: a bunch of gun owners paranoid that a black president is coming to get them. Never mind the fact that under President Obama's gun rights have expanded considerably. But facts aside, I think we found one of the people who recently subscribed to Glenn Beck's new Paranoia Palooza online TV station, Wayne LaPierre. And that's very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Kevin in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to weigh in on the Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Given names of family members. And I kind of think that's kind of extortion. I mean, we have people in our families that are this way and that way, and I don't like it, and I think there is a better way to go about it.
So you think they stepped over the line when they put out the family members' names?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you for weighing in, Kevin. I'm sorry. I thought that was the end of it. But anyway, Barb in New London, Wisconsin. Hey, Barb, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to say it was great seeing you at the Fighting Bob Fest.
Well, thank you. That was a lot of fun.
And yeah, it was great. And I'm a newly retired teacher, and I have to say I've never heard of you before February, which is embarrassing.
Well, that's fine.
But it's just amazing, I think, what's going on here. When we were protesting, the only information I could get was to go to Free Speech TV to see what was going on, even in Madison. Mm-hmm. And the revolution, I think there is one going on. I mean, even when I was on my way home today in the car on the public radio station, I was listening, and they were taking suggestions for October, what to talk about, and a lot of progressives were calling in. One of them, in fact, even wanted you on the program and talking about, you know, the free trade and the taxation and money as speech, corporations as people.
Yep.
And it's just like a whole new thing for me. And well, I'm like, I'm trying to be the eyes and ears of all the people who don't have the time or the energy. And, you know, I don't know if that's the right way to go, but that's what I'm feeling right now.
Well, that's great, Barb. Thank you for calling and weighing in and being part of the solution rather than the problem, as I think people have been saying in this country since its founding. Thank you very much, Barb. Great to hear from you. Richard in Asheville, North Carolina. Richard, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to speak about the officer that had mazed an anonymous outing of his family members' names. I think it's totally appropriate. And the reason I think that is I think, you know, what a great deterrent to prevent, you know, officers from abusing their power by knowing that they're putting their family at risk by overstepping the boundaries.
But isn't that a little like saying that if somebody goes out and robs a bank, that we should take their children and put them in jail along with them because that's going to deter them from robbing banks?
I wouldn't say put their children in jail, but I think there should be a certain amount
publicly shame them.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe. You know, I think that might stop people from doing such things.
I don't think that a criminal's children should pay the penalty for the criminal's crime. And whether the criminal is a police officer who has gone beyond the pale or whether the criminal is, you know, a bank robber, I just don't think that their kids should be the victim, should have any taint of association with that crime. And
I mean, the reality is, though, you know, if this becomes a common practice, we're going to see a lot more officers in the faceless black helmets like you saw in Minneapolis.
Well, the problem, here's what I see as the big problem, is that this will, and this is where, again, I'm quite ambivalent about this, that by going this far, this quickly, that what Anonymous has done is, I believe, established what will be used by right-wingers as the legal basis for laws against people photographing police, and might speed up the process of criminalizing the photographing police, and, you know, which already is way too criminalized. And I think that we should have absolutely no laws against photographing public, any public official in a public place. And, you know, it's in private, it's a whole different thing. But in a public place, you know, we should have the right to do that, to photograph anybody. And right. The thing that really concerns me is the lockdown on that. And in fact, one of the five people who was arrested in New York was arrested for photographing the police. And so, you know, apparently that's a crime, and that shouldn't be a crime. So that's my concern. Richard, thank you very much for the call. Your point is, it was interesting, the evolution of your answer. David in Springfield, Mass. Hey, David.
Tom, of all of the programs that Roosevelt's administration ever put through, I believe the evidence is clear. The two best programs helped the most number of people, Social Security and Tennessee Valley Authority. The Social Security program, as you know, and other people know, even the people that are against it, it's a very strong program. There's nothing financially unsound about it. And if the tax was levied beyond $106,000, where it stops at the moment, and was put forward on at least the first million, there'd be a lot more money coming into the
This is the point that Bernie Sanders made in the law that he proposed, and that was that if you started simply having people pay Social Security tax after they make $250,000 and up, then the system will be solvent forever. And he's right. Nancy in Portland. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, I think Anonymous could be a police mole, wants the protesters to look bad.
Oh, that's an interesting consideration.
He sure had an awful lot of information awfully fast. All the family members, all the old addresses, and quite a campaign
which the backlash against the police now could be the backlash against the protesters for doing this.
Well, that's my concern, and that's very interesting. I've told this story before. I was in SDS in the 60s, in the late 60s, in East Lansing, and there was this one guy who was always yelling, you know, kill the pigs. I mean, that was his phrase, and you know, burn them down and stuff like that. And he was calling for us to literally, do Molotov cocktails on buildings and things. And about 5 years later, when I think it was Brad Lang, it might have been Mike Price, one of the guys who was affiliated with SDS back in the day. It's interesting, when I interviewed David Stockman from the Reagan administration last week, before we went on the air, we were comparing the names of the SDS people that we knew in common at MSU in East Lansing.
Oh,
and,
my.
Because he was hanging around with SDS back at the same time. But in any case, one of those people sued the Michigan State Police, the Red Squad unit, and got the files. And we discovered that guy, who, and not just him, there were others, but I remember this guy in particular. This guy who was always calling for violence was actually a police officer. And
they're more devious and more sophisticated today.
Yeah, I mean, none of us took him all that seriously. We thought he was a crackpot. Although
they're much more devious today.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea that this might be a false flag operation, shall we say.
Yes.
I don't know. I suspect that it's just a group of young people who are saying, you know, we are sick and tired of the brutality of power in this country, and the brutality of power that has evicted people from their homes, that has ripped off people from their savings, that has destroyed their jobs, and that is now macing, you know, women who are standing to protest.
Exactly. They're on the moral high ground, but they're losing it with this tactic against children and families.
That would be my concern. Nancy, thank you very much for the call. Very, very interesting conversation. We'll see where this goes. Back with more of your calls, your thoughts on this. And, you know, another question is, should we be working for legislation that makes it illegal to criminalize photographing police?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That was a double negative. Should we be pushing for legislation that makes it perfectly legal to photograph police? Period. Nationwide. Yes.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Adam in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to let you know, first time caller, really appreciate what you guys are doing.
Thanks.
And as I guess my fellow Redditors would say, long time lurker, first time poster.
Okay.
But just getting to the point real quick about how Nancy had talked about, you know, the possibility of Anonymous being a mole or something like that. I just wanted to raise light to, you know, some of the previous things that Anonymous has done, you know, as far as, you know, outing the Westboro Baptist Church,
right,
catching some of these kids on YouTube who are abusing animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, you know, with the stuff going on with the pepper spray and, you know, spraying poison into, you know, these fine ladies' faces.
Right.
This stuff is unacceptable. You know, this is 2011. These people should definitely be held accountable. And I mean, the internet is a powerful thing. The information that they found is freely available.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the other side of the argument, is that, you know, they posted the names and presumably addresses of his neighbors or of his relatives, but the flip side of it is, it, you know, anybody with a computer and a little bit of knowledge about how to how to search things could probably track that down once they knew who he was.
Right,
and
that's what Anonymous
is doing.
They're just using Facebook and Google, pretty much.
Yeah, so you could make the argument that, you know, it didn't matter whether they did it or not because the information was freely available. I personally think it somewhat diminishes their moral high ground, and I would love to see Anonymous always stand on the moral high ground. But
fair point.
You know, but that, you know, I'm not part of Anonymous. I don't run Anonymous, and I wouldn't presume to tell them how to do it. I think, though, that identifying the police officer was a service to all of us, assuming that they have done so accurately. Thank you, Adam, for the call. Janine in Santa Fe. Hey, Janine.
Hi, Tom. I think what we're seeing is the militarization of our police officers, and I think it's a very dangerous state of affairs in this country. I saw a snippet of a training video where my perception was that they were being trained that we, the American people, are the enemy. Mm-hmm. And I track this. I get emails about this kind of stuff, and I've been seeing police state actions occurring across the country from, I believe it's Tennessee. I hope I'm not misnaming the state here. But where the police are actually shaking down out-of-state license plates. I have friends that did not want to drive through there because they'd heard about it.
Mm.
We have police attacking citizens who film them. I absolutely agree. I don't think there's any expectation of privacy on in a public venue. I mean, that's absurd. Mm. And the fact that we even need to reiterate that we have that right is disturbing to me.
Yeah, and I feel the same way about airports, by the way. Let me get that in there.
Yes. Well, yeah, that was in my next point, was absolutely, I think that part of this is that Americans are feeling simply assaulted on a daily basis, really, that our civil liberties are being consistently trampled. I mean, the airports are a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, and that's really the core of the issue.
Yeah, and then there's a presumption of guilt rather than a presumption of innocence.
Absolutely. And I mean, I also think that it's slave training and it's prisoner training.
Yes.
I mean, look at assume the position.
Yep.
You know, I think there's far more going on there than what people are really aware of. And I think it's a conditioning.
It's herd training. And I'll tell you, the last time I went through an airport, which was just last weekend, I was debating with myself, if they got one of these Chertoff porno X-ray scanners, am I going to say, OK, grope me? And then have them open my suitcase and take all my personal items out and spread them all over so everybody can see them and make the big deal about it and do the whole hoopla, or not. And, fortunately, I just went through a magnetometer. I didn't have to make that decision, part of that decision was how much time do I have before my plane, and am I willing to be delayed by a half hour if that turns into that? And should
right.
we even live in a country where you're having to, where a,
have
you know, an average
decisions.
Person is having to ask themselves those questions about,
right.
about exposure to X-rays? And for that matter, should the people working at the TSA be exposed to X-rays? These machines do not have lead shields around them, just like in a dentist's office. I mean, nowadays they build dentist's offices with lead shields in the walls. And
that's
it's like,
absolutely
so,
right.
So anyway, good point. Janine, thank you very much for calling and making it. Michael in Missoula, Montana. Joe in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Again, love your show. We really appreciate
Thanks.
What you guys
not,
are doing.
Not necessary, the compliments. I appreciate it, but it's not necessary. Thank you. So what's up?
Okay. Just a little bit about the media, like you were saying. Again, they're just becoming less and less effective. I've heard nothing about the protest incidents in New York, even less about the ones that are going to happen in Los Angeles. And, again, I think everything ties together. The campaign finance, the lobbyists, everything together, corporate sponsors are all in control of the important things that they need to be taking place, which is free speech, the news media getting their job done, and it's just a problem. It's killing this country, and we as Americans need to stand up and not let a certain few destroy and kill the great and the many.
Yeah, very well said. Very well said, Joe. Thank you very much. And here's the weird irony of this whole thing. Is that there was very little media attention outside of, like liberal talk radio or progressive talk radio and progressive media, alternative media, indie media. There was very little and Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, things like that. There was very little attention being paid to what was going on with the Occupy Wall Street movement until this cop sprayed these women who were just standing there in the eyes with pepper spray. Which, by the way, may right now or may 10 or 15 years from now have damaged their vision. And, I mean, this stuff is serious stuff. There was very little publicity about it until the police turned violent. And I think you could make a case that the police violence, because of our if it bleeds, it leads media, our news media, is probably going to be one of the things that propels this into the media. So in a way, he kind of did the movement a favor. Coming tomorrow, much like, the Boston Massacre, the British soldier who said fire into those guys, it started the American Revolution. Coming tomorrow, time for Outrage. I'll be talking with author-activist Stefan Hessel about his little book and how it inspired the grassroots protests in Europe and asking the question, are we ready for the same in America? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.